Candace Millard is a writer, a really successful one. So the image of a starving artist typing precious words at a rickety desk in some dusty old attic doesn't apply. She goes to work every morning, like a lot of people, in a crisp, clean office park overlooking parking lots in Overland Park.
There's a lot to writing that's just sitting down and pounding it out and then wrestling with it until it's something that you would want to read yourself. And so I kind of like the idea of seeing all these people, taking life seriously and going to work and, doing what they need to do. And I hope doing what they enjoy.
At her desk, she's surrounded by photographs of people who matter to her. Her family.
Oh, so those are my children, Emery, Conrad, and Petra.
And great characters from history, like James Garfield, the second U.S. president to be assassinated. In the framed photo on her shelf, he's sitting in a chair, not signing legislation, but welcoming his tiny daughter Molly into his lap.
He was so smart and so kind and so brave and had so much promise for our young country. But he was also an incredibly devoted and loving husband and father.
The handsome guy in a uniform? That's Winston Churchill.
He's young and he's has his carefully combed hair. He's wearing his uniform. That's actually right before the Boer War. This is when he was fighting in India and Afghanistan and looking very self-possessed and a little self-impressed, which he was both.
There is a reason why she treats photographs of famous statesmen like portraits of beloved uncles.
I feel like, I don't know if I should, but I do feel like they become family. It's 4 or 5 years really trying to understand these people and not just understand sort of what they did or even what they're thinking, but who they were, what their character was. And so when it's over and it's time to move on to something else, I always kind of miss them.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll hear about the writing life of Candace Millard. Her books are about dramatic, vulnerable moments in the lives of powerful men, moments historians had previously treated as side notes. And dry biographies, these are not. All three of her books have been New York Times bestsellers. She's here in the studio with me now. Good morning, Candace.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
Thanks for coming. I mean, I love the idea that the people you write about, that they are your personal companions. So like you spend 3 or 4 years at a time hanging out every single day with James Garfield or Teddy Roosevelt or Winston Churchill, and then it's time to say goodbye.
Yeah, it's kind of heartbreaking, to be honest. I do miss them. You know, I spend so much time with them, and it's not just the time I spend when I'm in my office officially working on my books or, you know, reading about them, writing about them, thinking about them, but it's throughout the day, you know, and when it's I'm in the pickup line to pick my kids up from school or I'm doing laundry at home or I'm making dinner, I'm making the bed, whatever, I'm always thinking about them. In the middle of the night, I'll wake up with a thought because, you know, your mind keeps working on something, which is something that I love about writing is that sometimes you don't have to be writing when you actually are. And so I'll wake up and I'll have a thought about these people who I really feel like I've come to know. And I'll scribble something down and I'll wake up in the morning and think, oh yeah, that's a great idea. That is an insight.
Do you remember can you think of a middle of the night thought? Like, because I think most people who take their jobs seriously wake up in the middle of the night with like, oh my God, I just realized this, or mm-hmm. I need to remember to do that. And I'm curious what it's like to be woken up with an insight into Winston Churchill's character, for example.
Well, usually it's an insight into how I'm going to describe him or how I'm going to tell this story. Because if you read a book, you usually think, well, that's the obvious way to tell the story. But the truth is, there are a million ways you could start out, and there are a million complications along the way. And so a big part of the job is just figuring out how you're going to explain it and how you're going to, you hope, bring this story to life. And it's not obvious when you're sort of staring at these mountains of research that you have. And so happily, thankfully, your mind keeps working on it. So that's usually what happens to me. I'll wake up in the middle of the night and I'll think, that's it. That's how I'm going to explain that, or that's how I'm going to get into the story. And I'll just jot down an idea to myself, just a couple of words. And I'm so grateful for it when I finally get to my office the next day and I'll look at that and I'll think, okay, thank you. I always laugh with my kids. I always say, you'll thank your previous self. So I'll think, thank you, past Candace, for coming up with this idea. And that helps me get into it. And it's a launching point for the day.
So these are not straightforward biographies. I've mentioned that. You don't start with the birth of your characters and follow their stories chronologically right up to the end. It's more like you find some intriguing drama that's been really right under our noses in history books for years. And you bring that story to life in a way that it's like, oh, maybe we should have wondered a whole lot more about that moment. So let's start with your first book. It's about Theodore Roosevelt, but not at the peak of his career. I mean, what a lot of people may not know is that he ran for office again after serving his terms and lost.
That's right. So he served two terms as president, but not two full terms. So he was initially made president when William McKinley was assassinated. And so he certainly could have run again. And he was very young. As you know, he was our youngest president. He was 42 when he became president. And he had still so much energy and excitement for life. But he had promised that he wasn't going to run again after his second term. So he left. He went to Africa. He went on this incredible collecting trip to Africa. But he was really unhappy with what Taft was doing in the White House. And so he came back and he decided to run again. He couldn't get the Republican nomination because obviously there was a Republican incumbent who was going to be running. So he ran as a progressive candidate and lost and was shocked and devastated, really. You know, and he also, in losing, he split the Republican vote, put a Democrat in the White House for the first time in a long time. And so he was a pariah among these people who had worshipped him for years.
The story you tell is about this man who had once been arguably the most powerful man in the world, now struggling with a bruised ego and being kind of a social outcast. And he goes on this trip, an expedition in South America, which could look to an observer like just another adventure for an outdoorsman. But because you set it against the backdrop of this loss, we really understand it as something where a lot is at stake for him personally.
That's right. He's proving something to everyone else, but mostly he's proving something to himself. And this is a pattern that he had throughout his life. Whenever he faced difficulty or despair, loss, sorrow, he would throw himself into these very difficult, very dangerous situations. So when he was at Harvard and his father died, he went to the backwoods of Maine. When his mother and his first wife died on the same night, that's when he went to the Badlands of the Dakotas. And when he's done with the presidency, he goes to Africa. But in this case, it just goes beyond anything he had ever experienced because he gets to South America. He's going to go on a speaking tour, and he thinks he'll go on a collecting trip at the same time. So he's not been really paying attention to the preparation. The foreign minister of Brazil says, well, you could do that, or you could do something a little more interesting. We just discovered the headwaters of this river, and we have no idea where it goes. And it's in the middle of the Amazon, deep in the Amazon rainforest. Of course, being Theodore Roosevelt, there's no way he's going to turn down that opportunity.
How did you identify this moment as one that could read like a novel if someone chose to write it that way?
Well, when you start to look at the basic story, you know right away that it's just incredible. And it's sort of the reason it was overlooked is because it's after his active political career. But three men died on this trip. One drowned. One was murdered. They left the murderer to certain death, horrible death in the rainforest. And Theodore Roosevelt nearly took his own life. So it's something that if you wrote it in a novel, no one would believe it. So, and you've got the Amazon. You know, I had just spent 6 years working at National Geographic. So here I have this incredible excuse to write about the Amazon rainforest, you know, the richest ecosystem on Earth. It was just a gift.
I want to get back to you being a National Geographic writer in a little while, but I'm very interested in your research process because we get so much depth you know, vivid descriptions, insights into motivations of major characters and minor characters, and details that I just read wondering how someone digs this stuff up. Because part of what is so enjoyable about reading your books is that the reader, I mean, you feel like you're there. But of course, even you, the author, you weren't there. You weren't even born yet, you know? I mean, this is history we're talking about. But here you are writing about, you know, the weather conditions in a way where I can feel it. Or like the Brazilian guy who led this expedition on the River of Doubt, you write that he had grown up more impoverished than anyone realized. And you talk about what time he woke up every day. You talk about what he ate and how he almost collapsed from malnourishment on his way to math class. You knew that it happened on his way to math class. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, thank you for saying that. And I'm so glad, because that's what I look for in a book as a reader. I want to immerse myself in the story and forget where I am and who I am and what's going on around me. And so the most important thing to me when I'm looking for a subject to write about is, do I have enough primary source material? So obviously, you need that for any kind of nonfiction writing, but especially for narrative nonfiction writing, where you're telling a story. You have to have not just, you know, a wealth of material, but you have to be drowning in it, where you think you'll never get through it. So letters and journals and newspaper articles. And I do go to these places. Obviously, I can't go back in time. I can't try time travel, which I would love to be able to do. But in a sense, I'm able to do that through the documents. But then I go to the places. I went to the River of Doubt, which is still incredibly remote. I tracked down this indigenous tribe that had haunted and attacked Roosevelt and his men at one point. And they still live much the way they have, not just for, you know, 100 years, but for 1,000 years. So I do everything I can to try to understand the story and the people in it.
Talk to me more about your trip to the River of Doubt.
So it was an incredible opportunity. It was one of the reasons I wanted to tell this story, so I could have a chance to do this. So I spent a lot of time in Rio just doing research on Rondon, who is a Brazilian co-commander, and museums and libraries and other archives. But then I wanted to go to this river. So what I had to do is I went to this little town called Porto Velho. I rented a plane. I hired a pilot. And I flew for hours over absolutely unbroken jungle from horizon to horizon. So I got to this little fishing camp that's near the northern end of the River of Doubt, now the Rio Roosevelt. And that was sort of my base of operations. I stayed in a little fishing camp. This guy who had set it up, the only thing he brought into the Amazon was a hammer and some nails, and everything else he took from the rainforest. I said it was like being on Gilligan's Island, you know. It was very simple, but beautifully done. And I was on the river. I flew up and down the river. I had all their coordinates. And so I dialed them up on my GPS. I could see where everything happened, and I could really get an understanding. But we had some pretty scary moments while we were there.
Like what?
So one day we had this little plane. Unfortunately, it was just a single engine plane, and we had been in a rubber tappers village. And it's a rainforest. And it was during the rainy season, which is the same time of year Roosevelt and his men were there. And so even when it's not raining, the air is just incredibly thick with moisture. And we went in. We spent several hours at this rubber tapping village. And we came back out, and I had a pretty inexperienced pilot, unfortunately. And he didn't sump the tank, and just kind of letting some of the moisture that had gathered out. And so we took off, and we were about 1,500 feet up. And if you've been in a little plane, you know it's really loud and shaking, and all of a sudden it was just silent, and we dropped like a stone.
Oh my!
Because
gosh,
the water had gotten into the engine, our only engine, and you know I knew that. In theory, it's possible to restart an engine when you're falling, but I'd obviously never seen it happen. And this kid was desperate. He was literally clawing at the controls. And all I could think, you know, my oldest daughter was 8 months old at that time, and she was here in Kansas City with my parents. And my husband was with me, and I thought, you know, we're idiots. We've just orphaned our child, you know, for what? And I also thought, if we crash, I hope we die pretty quickly, because otherwise we're going to have a horrible death, because we were so remote in the rainforest, nobody would find us. Amazingly, thank you. He was able to restart the engine and we pulled back up. But the pilot was so terrified after that that he just wanted to land. And I mean, I had put a lot of time and effort and money into getting there, and we still had a lot to do. So
there was no part of you that also just wanted to land?
No, you know, I guess your survivor instincts just they kick in, and I wanted to get the story while I was there.
Was there anything that experience helped you understand about Roosevelt's experience? I mean, not just the experience of visually observing what was going on around you and like feeling that kind of moisture on your skin, that kind of thing, but also that near-death experience and having that experience in this remote place.
I think so, because the interesting thing about the Amazon, obviously, where everybody is and should be concerned about it, you know, we're losing something like 50 acres a minute. And you do see occasional scars with the soybean plantations and things. And it's a real danger to the entire planet, what's going on in the Amazon. But you also see how vast it is and how dense it is. And the Amazon, to a great extent, takes care of itself. And so having that near-death experience there, you have a lot of respect for the rainforest and for the creatures that live in it. You know, while we were there, a man escaped from a prison near the rainforest and within minutes was killed by a poisonous snake. So it happens all the time.
So what is an experience like that and the lessons you personally draw from it? I mean, I know that you're not writing about yourself when you're writing about these characters, but do you use your own emotional experiences?
I don't think I use my emotional experiences, but I do use all my other senses. So being there, for instance, one of the things I wanted to try to understand, I couldn't understand before I went there, how is it that they were starving to death? They were starving to death on this expedition. They kept losing all their provisions and all their canoes. But you think, here's Teddy Roosevelt, this great hunter. Here's Candido Rondon, who spent most of his life in the Amazon charting it. In the richest ecosystem on Earth. So how is it that they're starving to death? And you go there and it's silent. It's absolutely silent. I mean, you see like a few monkeys up in the trees. You see a caiman maybe disappearing into the water. But anything you could get to, anything you could eat is almost impossible. And it's evolution. You know, it's evolution. Everything is incredibly good at either being a predator or not being prey. And in order to do that, you've got to disappear.
And surviving in this particular environment.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's incredibly evolved and complex and beautiful and fascinating.
I understand you had another firsthand experience that gave you a particular kind of insight into Roosevelt's experience. Something that happened while you were editing River of Doubt. And what might have motivated Roosevelt to keep going and keep fighting to survive on that expedition?
That's right. So I had been working on the book for, you know, almost 4 years, 3 to 4 years, and put everything I had into it and an understanding, not just the story, but Roosevelt himself. And near the end, I was expecting my second child, and I had a publication date set. This is my first book. My publisher doesn't really know anything about me, and I'm trying to deliver. And the final edits are due, and we've got these tight deadlines. And I get a call one day from my doctor, and she said, look, we saw something on a sonogram, on your last sonogram, and we need you to come in for a more detailed sonogram. And I went in, and they found that there was what they called a mass, but ended up being a malignant tumor in the child, in my daughter. And so I had to have her that day. I had 3 hours to go home, pack a bag, get back to the hospital.
How far along were you at this point?
Well, so happily, I was 36 weeks. So her lungs were developed. She absolutely could be safely born. But emergency C-section. She goes to Children's Mercy, and so. I have to call my editor, who didn't even know I was pregnant, because I thought, it doesn't matter. He doesn't need to know. You know, we'll get it done. But I have to say, look, you need to buy me some more time. But what was interesting is that then sitting in the hospital room at Children's Mercy, day after day with her, she's getting treatment, she's getting chemo, and I'm watching this little child, and I'm trying to, in spare moments, read through the final proof, so this book. It finally occurred to me what it was all about for Theodore Roosevelt. It may have begun with him trying to prove something to himself, but it ended with him trying to save his son's life. So his son Kermit was with him on this expedition, and he was terrified that he was going to die.
That his son
was going to die. That's right. And it really is astonishing that any of them survived. And so at one point, you know, Roosevelt's so ill, he has this lethal dose of morphine. He thinks it's the right thing. He's going to take his own life and they can go on without him. And the only reason he doesn't, and this is astonishing to think, the only reason Theodore Roosevelt didn't commit suicide in the middle of the Amazon is that he realized that the best way to save his son was to let his son save him. And he let Kermit take over, and Kermit was really the hero of this expedition. He got them all out of life. And I did. I understood. I felt this connection to Theodore Roosevelt that I hadn't in all those years I had tried to understand him.
We've got to take a short break from this conversation with writer Candace Millard. She visited our studios back in April. I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR Central Standard. We'll be back in just a minute. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this morning we're listening back to one of our favorite shows from April 2017. It's a portrait session with writer Candace Millard, whose dramatic portrayals of history's famous statesmen read like novels, even though they are nonfiction. And we've just been hearing about the crazy lengths Candace goes to in the name of research. Hi, Candace.
Hi.
Before we get back to your writing and your process, I want to learn more about you and your background. Where did you grow up?
So I grew up in a little town in Ohio. I always say, it's like the perfect childhood, I think. So I spent all my time either all summer going to the pool or the library, and the library was all year round. Really, my childhood revolved around the library. So I just always loved to read, and it was a place in a time where there wasn't all this pressure on kids, you know, to achieve, and so I got to just daydream and read, and but it never occurred to me, because I didn't know anybody who was a writer, and didn't occur to me that actually I could do that, or, you know, that was even in the realm of possibility. So I just thought I would either be a librarian or I would teach. And that was kind of the path I took for much of my life.
When you talk about being in the library and loving to read but not knowing writers, tell me more about who you did know. Who was your community?
So it was a largely blue-collar town, and, instead of kind of dreaming about going to an Ivy League college, most of my friends, you know, dreamed about a good factory job or, you know, extending their education. But there was a car plant there, and there was a racetrack there. Paul Newman came there one time, but it was just a really a safe, happy place. It was very wooded. And I spent a lot of time kind of wandering around in the woods and by the streams. And my parents, incredibly loving, supportive. I had three sisters, and my father worked for the United Telephone Company. And that's how we actually came to Kansas City. Originally, he was transferred to Sprint. But, you know, he didn't go to college. He worked on telephone lines, and then he took a test to get a job in the office and worked his way up that way.
Were you always fascinated by history?
I was, because I love stories. And that's what history is. It's the story of people's life. And I think that, you know, unfortunately, if you get a history teacher who maybe just kind of talks dates, or, you know, just kind of you sort of trudge along through history, you forget.
Flashcards.
You forget that these are people who experienced joy and despair and triumph and incredible failure and frustration, just like we did. And to have history without that, I think, takes away, a central truth.
Do you remember, I mean, when you talk about these are people who have joys and triumphs, it seems like to really understand that, you have to be able to relate it to something personal. I mean, do you remember observing people in your life from a young age, like things happening around you in a particular way? Because you have a gift not only for like human motivation and how it guides like characters, whether they're famous or not, how it guides their next moves, but also for the music of people's language. I mean, which seems to me that that's also an observation skill of a kind. Like, you've been praised as being a master of the quote, and I think it's true. Like, when you quote some historical figure in your narrative, you found just this perfect little nugget that was buried away somewhere. But that's an observation skill. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. I think that I'm better at observing things that are written and that are in the past. I don't know that I would be a great journalist, for example. I think it all comes out of just a love of reading. And the more reading, you know, everybody says it, but it's true. If you want to be a writer, you have to read a lot and you have to write a lot. And so it's just a culmination of reading and reading and reading and an effort of trying to understand somebody. And then you can see everything and you can kind of weigh it. And I think that then you can see those quotes that really matter and hopefully get to the point of what you're trying to explain.
So you had three sisters. And so this household of four girls, I'm wondering, you know, in sibling groups, people get kind of pigeonholed, like, you're the adventurous one and you're the timid one or whatever.
Yeah, sure.
Which one were you?
I was the daydreamer, absolutely. You know, I was the one who would always like go upstairs to get something and then an hour later they'd be like, where is she? And I forgot what I was going to do and I was just daydreaming about something. Always the nose in the book. That was me.
So tell me more about this move to Kansas City. You were in high school?
Yeah, and actually, it was really important to me and ended up being a great thing. It didn't seem so at the time because it was right before my senior year of high school. I had grown up in this little town, and I moved. I went to Shawnee Mission Northwest, and it was much, much larger than my high school had been.
And before a senior year, when you're about to be like, we're ending this all together.
I know, and I'm ending it alone. But what was great is that I ended up taking a journalism class. And they asked me if I wanted to write for the paper, and I said, sure, why not? I don't have anything else to do. And so I did that, and it helped me get a scholarship to Baker University. And then I didn't pursue journalism, but I did pursue writing, you know, and reading, and I was an English major. So, and also I started studying, which I really, I've been a kind of very average student before that, but I thought, well, I may as well see what I can do as far as, you know, actually getting good grades. And so it all kind of started there.
When you say you started pursuing writing, what did that look like at that time? I mean, what year about are we talking about at Baker University?
So I went there in 89, and I was an English major, and I thought I was going to teach. And so it was more about reading, continuing to read, and reading and writing kind of scholarly papers. And then I went to Baylor for graduate school, and it was the same thing. So all I had written were sort of scholarly papers and my thesis for graduation. And so it wasn't until I moved back to Kansas City penniless after I got my master's degree, moved back in with my parents and started looking for a job. And then I thought, maybe I can be a writer. But it was more about kind of magazines and things. And my dream job was National Geographic.
When you first got some work writing for magazines, what kind of magazines were they? You don't start with National Geographic.
No, I certainly didn't. It was a long road. So I worked for trade journals. So my first job was working for this little trade journal called Veterinary Forum. It was for veterinarians. I'd never even had a pet. I knew nothing about animals. But, you know, you kind of figure it out. So it's a good experience. And then I worked for a company. It's called Intertech at the time, but it's been bought and the name has been changed many times over, but it's over on Metcalf. And I worked for a bunch of different just tech journals, just doing everything. It was really great experience because you have to kind of just try everything out. And so you learn. So when you go to somewhere like National Geographic, you just do one little thing, your little portion. And so you don't get an opportunity to kind of understand how the magazine works as a whole.
This trade journal writing experience seems like it would be really also good practice at imagining the life of someone else. Mm-hmm. Because when you're talking about writing for a veterinary journal, having never had a pet, do you remember having, like, having an assignment and having to really combine research and imagination to pull this off?
Yes. And I was always looking, I mean, it's mostly like, oh, you know, there's an argument between veterinarians and like Petco or something like that, you know, or something about heartworm or something. But I was always looking for an opportunity to do something that I was interested in. And I remember there was one story about this veterinarian, and he was in the Congo and he was working with gorillas. And so I, you know, I spent so much time on this. And my editor, I think, was surprised. He's like, okay, this is a bigger story than I imagined. But I got to call him and I got to do research about the Congo. And so I love that, and I made the most of it.
So how did you make the leap from that to writing for National Geographic?
So it's, you know, what they always say about luck being the confluence of preparation and opportunity. So I had been trying and trying and reading and writing, and they had a hotline with for jobs at National Geographic that I called every single day, literally every day, and they never had anything. But then, and this is not a lie, my boyfriend, who's now my husband, my boyfriend's college roommate's twin brother worked for, he was with the Peace Corps. For 6 years, he had been in the Peace Corps in Sierra Leone, and he lived in Washington, D.C. So I thought, I'm going to go into the Peace Corps. I'm going to totally change everything. I'm going to have an experience. I'm going to learn a language. And so I called him, and he said, well, if you're going to do this, and I was 28 at the time, so it was kind of old for the Peace Corps. And he said, you should come to D.C., and we should talk, and you should go. The headquarters were there. And so I went to D.C., and that night we had dinner, and he said, if you could do anything, what would you do? And I said, well, I'd work for National Geographic, but I have no idea how to make that happen. He said, I have a friend at National Geographic. Why don't we stop by and see him tomorrow on our way to the Peace Corps offices?
Do you think he was getting the idea that the Peace Corps was not for you?
I don't know. I mean, I think he's just this great guy who, like, wanted to help me follow my dreams. It's like, well, if that's your dream, let's give it a shot. And so we actually never made it to the Peace Corps offices because I met this guy. There was an opening. I interviewed and I got it.
The connection between National Geographic, which, of course, like that, sounds so amazing to work for this publication where you would travel the world and experience things firsthand and bring back these reports. But it does seem so different in a way from writing about history. I mean, on the surface of it, mm-hmm. Under the surface, is there more that these two things have in common than people might imagine?
Well, I sort of did what I did at Veterinary Forum, where I kind of turned, always trying to turn it into something that really interested me. So obviously I'm interested in natural history. I'm interested in cultures. I'm interested in rivers, everything that science that National Geographic writes about. But what I did is I made myself the point person for stories on history and biography. So I was always looking for stories in those areas. I would vet stories coming in from those areas, and I would present them to the editorial board. So me personally, I had to work on everything, which was so fun. My husband was always like, this is not a job. It was always like, oh, I spent the day with the bee curator at the Smithsonian or, you know, the giant squid or something. But I was always looking for stories. Like, I begged them to do a story on Emily Dickinson, you know, and I spent my own money and vacation time going to Amherst, begging. They never did it. But they should have. But so I just always was looking for opportunities to throw myself into a story of history.
How did you end up finding your niche as someone who writes books about these underappreciated historical dramas? I mean, I see the connection now, but yeah, do you remember having that aha moment of I could write a book?
So I was living in Washington, D.C., in a job that I loved, and I got married, and my husband has a company here in Kansas City. He had been a journalist. We've been with the New York Times for many years, but had left to go to law school and start this company. And so I knew I was going to move here eventually. Actually, we got married, and I got pregnant, and I was still living in Washington because I didn't know what I would do in Kansas City that I loved as much. And he said, you should write a book. And I thought, well, that's, you know, far easier said than done. But I started to think about it, and I had lunch with a friend who had just written a book about the election of 1912. And he said, have you heard about this trip that Roosevelt took? And I started doing research. And I, again, it was just this incredible gift, really, that he gave me, because it's this amazing story. And that was the launch pad.
So it's interesting to me. I mean, you talked about really wanting National Geographic to take this story about Emily Dickinson. It is interesting that the three people you've profiled in your books, Roosevelt, Churchill, and Garfield, are all men. I mean, mm-hmm. do you think that you'll ever take on a woman as your main character?
I would love to. I mean, the harsh reality is that for so many years, women weren't allowed to do these incredible things, right? And there are women who did, against all odds, did incredible things. But it's just harder. It's just a smaller pool of finding. And I had hoped to write about Marie Curie next. And I spent a lot of time researching her, and I learned so much about her. I mean, obviously, her discoveries are incredible, but her personal story is also amazingly compelling. The problem is that most of the action takes place in her mind, you know, and it's really hard to turn that into a page turner. And I also, the primary source material, while there, it's not as much as I need. And did you know that most of it is still radioactive?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, you have to sign a release waiver, work in a hazmat suit or something to work with her papers.
Wow. You know, it occurs to me also that part of what you seem to be writing about a lot of the time is really power and the relationship between power and ego.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious about whether, I mean, so I think about that in terms of gender too. I mean, mm-hmm. like, if you're interested in someone who holds all this power and finding these moments where maybe the outcome isn't so certain for them, things like that, mm-hmm. that's going to also limit your pool. But by daring to put yourself and your readers in these particular men's shoes, in a way, do you think that you are kind of challenging the idea of power or the idea of them being so different from the rest of us?
Well, I like the idea of putting these very powerful, very successful men in situations, not putting them, finding them in these situations where they are unsure. They are searching for a foothold. They're struggling. And I think that's when your real character is revealed. You know, James Garfield, the subject of my second book, he said that when someone is really sick, he called it the bed of the sea, where you can really see who they are because everything's kind of stripped bare. And I think that's absolutely true, and that's what interests me.
We will get right back to this portrait session with Candace Millard after a short break. This conversation originally aired on KCUR's Central Standard back in April. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and today we're doing a portrait session with Candace Millard. She's the best-selling author of 3 books about historical statesmen in precarious circumstances, is I guess one way to put it. Hi again, Candace.
Hi, Gina.
And we were just talking about that you had hoped to write a book about Marie Curie, and that the material you needed either was not there or is still radioactive. But I'm interested in, you know, you mentioned that you didn't have enough material, but also not the kind you needed.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain what is the kind of material you need?
So obviously you need journals, letters, newspaper articles, but you need dialogue for one thing, and you need action, at least for the kind of books that I write. The story has to be moving forward, propelling you forward. And so obviously on the River of Doubt, they're literally physically being pulled on this river. And so things continue to happen and you're moving forward.
And it sounds like everyone kept a journal.
Yeah, most people did. And that's, you know, a concern going forward, you know, with so many people, you know, tweeting or on Instagram or whatever, and not writing as much as they used to. You get so much insight into somebody's life and their thoughts and their character by reading their journals and other people's journals about them, you know. But I will say that the one good thing, I think, with technology for the kind of work that I do is that you can find anything now, anything on the internet. And sometimes all you need is a hook. So I'll find somebody's name and I'll think, I wonder who that is. And I'll just start searching around and I'll find something about them and I'll keep pulling on that line and pulling on that line. And then you reach out to people and then you go to archives. But sometimes you need that beginning point and you can often find that on the internet.
Your husband and your kids have come up a couple of times sort of in mention. And I'm curious, I mean, Your husband used to work as a foreign correspondent, and the two of you met in D.C., is that right?
We actually met here in
Kansas City. Okay.
Right. So he was the bureau chief in Managua, Nicaragua. He covered Latin America. He also was a bureau chief in Mexico. But then he left. When I met him, he had just started this company in Kansas City, and then he was going to law school at Harvard. So every week, he would spend half the week in Cambridge and half the week in Kansas City. It was just staggering. I can't believe he did it, but he made it happen. And so I always say I found him in the Yellow Pages, which I literally did. So young people today are like, Yellow Pages. But when I moved back from Texas, I opened the Yellow Pages. I called every publisher in Kansas City looking for a job. And his company began as a publishing company. And his was the last one. It's Ulig.
So it starts LLC. With the letter U.
Exactly. And everybody else had turned me down. I was so beaten down. I almost didn't call him. I thought, I may as well. And he's the only one. He's like, sure, come on in. I'll talk to you. And I freelanced for him for a couple of months, just proofreading. And then I got a full-time job. And he always makes it very clear that we didn't start dating until after I got a job somewhere else.
Ethics.
Yes, always.
Well, and I'm curious, I guess, about how someone who's spent time as a foreign correspondent and someone who's delving into sort of these key figures in international affairs, but in the past, like, what kind of dinner conversation that makes for?
Well, we have a lot of common interests. He's also very interested in history, and he's very interested in language, and he's especially interested in etymology. And so our kids groan about it now, but we always say they will appreciate it someday. So most of our dinner conversation is about words. And so somebody will say some word, and Mark will say, well, that's an interesting word. Let's look it up. Where does that come back? And it can't just go back to its Latin base. It has to go to Proto-European. So he's always going back. Where does it come from? And what other words is it connected to? And it's fascinating, and it's so much fun.
How does your children have also come up a couple of times, other than, you know, the kind of insight that motherhood can provide into, like, just someone else's very personal human situation? How does motherhood affect your approach to being a writer? Or does it? Do you think it does?
I think it actually, you know, a lot of people think, oh, it must be hard to be, you know, a mother of three children and working at the same time. And there are times when it's difficult. When I'm on a research trip or when I'm on a book tour, my parents have to come and move in with us for a couple of months. But day to day, it actually is a really good thing because it shapes my day. So if I knew that I had all day to get it done and all night, and I think it would be harder to be really disciplined. But I know I have this window between drop off and pick up. And so I've got to go in and lock down and really work during those times.
That's interesting. Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote this article in the New York Times a while back just about her life and career. And she talked about a similar thing, just that she had a sense of, I don't know, very strictly scheduling out what was happening during what hours of the day.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
As a human being, do you learn things from the characters you write about? Like, you talk about spending time with them, and when you spend time with people, you usually observe them doing things, and there will be moments where it's either you observe something that you're like, oh, you know, that's a thing not to do in life, or you observe something where you're like, oh, that's how you handle that gracefully, or you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I do from all of them. And one of the things that I've taken away from it, from writing about different kinds of people who themselves have different backgrounds, I think it would be a very difficult thing to be the child or descendant of a famous person. And it makes me very, again, very grateful for my own childhood and want for my own children this very normal childhood that they have. Because if you look at, for instance, Roosevelt's family, you know, very wealthy, very, very famous, and they have wonderful people who were very good to me, but they've struggled. You know, they kind of have their demons because it's so hard to be. I mean, imagine being Winston Churchill's son, you know, because these famous men, especially someone like Winston Churchill, he lives to be 90 years old, incredibly ambitious the entire time, cannot sort of pass the baton to the next generation, just can't. And so that's so hard. And now the Garfield family, he was forgotten, and they didn't have any money, and most of them still live in the part of Ohio where he lived wonderful, happy, down-to-earth people.
Interesting. So, like, the spoils of power, you kind of, by spending time with these powerful people, decided that that's not for you?
Absolutely. It's absolutely not for me. I mean, I'm grateful that there are people who take on those roles. I think we need them. We certainly needed Winston Churchill during World War II. Theodore Roosevelt was a great leader, and we need those people who step up. But there are definitely sacrifices that come along with that.
What are you working on now?
So I just started a new book, and it's about the discovery of the source of the Nile. So it's about these two men, Richard Burton and John Hanning Speke. It's in the mid-1800s. Burton was this incredible guy. He was expelled from Oxford when he was 21. He taught himself 29 languages plus another 15 dialects. He disguised his Arabic was so good that he went into Mecca disguised as an Arab. And it was obsessed with finding the source of the Nile. And he was connected with this guy, John Hanning Speke, who was just an officer in the British military. And they had this sort of litany of horrible, horrible things that happened to them. And then finally, it ends up being Speke who discovers the source and not Burton. And then there's this huge betrayal, and it builds up to this very tragic culmination, shocking culmination. Anyway, it's a story that I fell in love with when I was at National Geographic and have been thinking about for years. And finally, I'm going to have an opportunity to tell it.
Tell me more about falling in love with the story at National Geographic. Can you take us with you on whatever assignment or whatever project you were working on?
Yeah, it was just one of these times. It was actually just at lunch. You know, we were talking and somebody was saying something about Richard Burton and somebody else was like, the actor? They're like, no, not the actor, the explorer. And started to talk
so
a little bit.
So this is a lunchtime conversation among National Geographic employees.
Yes, exactly, which is one of the reasons I loved working there so much. And people always coming in from the field with these crazy stories. And so, yeah, it was always sparking your imagination. And so I started doing more research just on my own and just was astonished by this story. I mean, it's just incredibly rich. And thinking about it now, I realize, oh, I get to go back to England and do research, and I'll go to Scotland and back to Africa, go to Lake Victoria. So it's another adventure for me personally, as well as remembering this adventure that these two men had.
Can you, I know you probably want to hang on to the details of this book, not just so that they will be a surprise when people read the book, but also I'm sure that you have your own creative process as you work through this information. So I don't want to disrupt it, but is there just any tiny little detail that you've discovered so far that is really exciting to you?
Yes, absolutely. I'm glad you asked, because as I try to do with all of the books I write about that go to another place, I try to understand the people who lived there, whose world this was. So River of Doubt, it was the Cinta Larga. Hero of the Empire, it was this guy, Solomon Plyke. But in this, I found this incredible guy. His name was Sidi Mubarak Bombay. And when he was a child, he was kidnapped and taken from Africa to India as a slave. And when his owner died, he made his way back to Africa and he became a guide. And so he was Burton and Speke's guide to Lake Tanganyika, also to Lake Victoria. And then Speke was sent back later to establish, yes, indeed, Victoria is the source of the Nile. And Bombay was, again, their guide. And then he was a guide for Henry Morton Stanley when he found David Livingstone. So he is, without question, the most accomplished guide in African exploration. And everybody says, you know, he's just this incredibly honest and kind and hardworking person. And even though he was obviously
you say everybody says it, but you mean
so,
like
everybody who wrote about him. So this is a good thing about it that I needed. So yeah, he's this great character, but how do I know anything about him?
Right.
Because Burton wrote about him, because Speke wrote about him, Grant wrote about him, Henry Morton Stanley wrote about him, and David Livingstone. So all these incredibly intelligent, educated, experienced book writers wrote about this guy, Sidi Mubarak Bombay. And so because of that, I can get to know him as well.
And you still get to do a lot of reading.
Yes, that's the best part.
Do you ever, at this point in your career and in your life, do you still get to read not for work?
Absolutely. Every night I read. I have a huge, huge tottering pile of books that I climb into every night.
Well, Candace Millard, it has really been fun getting to know you this morning.
You as well. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Candace Millard is the author of three books, River of Doubt, Theodore Roosevelt's Darkest Journey, Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President, and Hero of the Empire, The Boer War, A Daring Escape, and the Making of Winston Churchill. This portrait session originally aired in April of 2017, and it's been fun listening back. We hope you enjoyed it. Go online to check out photographs of Candace by Paul Andrews. They're at kcur.org/centralstandard. And if you want to nominate a portrait session subject, go right ahead. They're in-depth interviews with the most interesting people in Kansas City. Email us about the fascinating person in your community, centralstandard@kcur.org. On tomorrow's show, we'll talk about a new book of poetry by Bob Stewart, editor of New Letters magazine. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Matt Groby. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date.